A young man was pastoring a church out of town, and he came into Curbansville. This is just several years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago. I'm not really certain how long ago it was. And he did what every pastor who visits another church does. He immediately got into evaluator mode. It's kind of a weird thing. Have you ever seen like teenage girls, when a new one comes in, they're all looking her up and down, like, I wonder what that is. You know, pastors do that when they see other churches. We just go into evaluator mode, like, what's with this church? And then afterward, he made this kind of report. He talked about the building. He said, you have a fantastic building. This is just such a great building. And you know, we're thankful to God for the facility we have. And then he said, and the service was great. The music, top notch. That was great music. And the preaching, woo, best I ever heard. No, he didn't say that part. But then he said this, and this is what seemed to strike him, maybe not, but this is something that struck him maybe the most, but it certainly struck him enough to mention it. He said, you have a lot of men who go to that church. There's just a lot of men in that church. And that is not by accident. Several years ago, when I was at General Counsel, when it was in Orlando, a good pastor friend of mine named Joe Burchell, some of you know Joe, he is now on staff at Lancaster Alliance Church in Lancaster County, but he grew up in Coalport, Pennsylvania. He came to me and he said, you have to read this book. It's called Why Men Hate Going to Church. Anytime Joe has asked me to read a book, I read it, because Joe's a pretty sharp guy. And so I took the book out of his hand. I said, I'll read it now. And he said, you won't have time to read it now. I said, are you kidding? I'm sitting in boring business meetings. I'll read it now. And so there at General Counsel, I read over 200 pages of a book called Why Men Hate Going to Church. And when I read it, I was troubled. I was troubled because it says some things about men that aren't real flattering. I was troubled because not every page of it, but most of it was spot on. Spot on. The author was right. There are a lot of reasons that men hate going to church. And so I came home and I prayed about it. And I thought, God, do I need to do anything with this? Am I part of the problem that men don't want to go to church? And I began to realize, kind of, Steve, kind of. So I made some changes. First, I started using, or I resumed. Resumed is the operative word here. I resumed using sports illustrations in sermons. In fact, I have three of them in this sermon today. Now, I know that women like sports, but generally, well, just look at the commercials, and you know who's watching. They're not selling Avon very often. Okay? They're selling Old Spice. And I about 10 years earlier, a dear woman whom I love and respect, she came to me and she had said to me, Pastor Steve, I hate it when you use sports illustrations, and when you do it, I just stop listening. I don't hear anything else you say. I don't do sports, and so I just disconnect and I don't hear anything else you say. And I tried to explain to her that God uses sports illustrations, and she's like, oh, no way. I said, yes, have you heard the Apostle Paul say, I run the race, I fight the good fight? That's like the Olympics. That's a sports illustration. But she wouldn't hear logic. And so she said, no, I don't like it. And so I stopped using sports illustrations. That was wrong. And after reading Why Men Hate Going to Church, I began to use them again. A second change that I made was regarding expletives. Now, hang on. I don't swear in sermons, at least not on purpose. And I never have, at least not on purpose. But I did use words like stupid. And as you might guess, a woman came to me and she said, stupid is a bad word. We don't use it in our house. You should not be using that in your sermon. And again, I tried to reason my way out of this. I said to her, you know that the Bible, God, uses the word stupid in the Bible, right? She said, no, he doesn't, but he does. I was thinking of places like Proverbs 12:1, where it says, whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. That's what it says right in the Bible. And that's how I had been using the word stupid. Now, I am not advocating using the word stupid in other places, in other contexts. I would never call someone I cared for, or even if I didn't care for, I would never say, you're just stupid. That wouldn't be right. But I think using the word the way God does, that's probably all right. And that's the way I was using it. But she would have no truck with reason. And so I replaced that word with words that have no punch. I mean, think about the punch. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge. But he who hates correction is silly. Doesn't work, does it? You just can't do that. And it was wrong for me to stop doing that. And after reading Why Men Hate Going to Church, I once again began to use some words that had some power behind them. The third change I made, and I can't say that I made it because we made it. It was hard for me. It regards the pulpit. I wanted to get rid of the pulpit since the day I laid eyes on it. When I candidated at Kerwinsville Alliance, I was like, how can I get that pulpit off of that platform? No kidding. I'm not kidding you. In his book, As One Without Authority, which the first edition came out in the 60s, 1969, Fred Craddock suggests that people no longer look to the pulpit for authority. They haven't for years. And so the pulpit is not a symbol of authority, so why do we use it? Hearing someone speak from a pulpit kind of feels like you're getting lectured. And people don't like to get lectured. And men hate getting lectured, right, men? Yep. We don't like that. But removing the pulpit was kind of like slaying a sacred cow in India, you know? It was really a hard thing to do. So for over a decade, I stood on a little piece of real estate right here. It was 16 inches wide with no steps there, communion table there. It is only by God's grace that I never sailed out over top of that thing, you know? I can remember almost slipping off of that many, many, many times through the years. Right? After reading Why Men Hate Going to Church, I finally had the courage. And it wasn't even me. It was another person in our congregation who addressed it. Hey, we got rid of that pulpit for Christmas. Why don't we just leave it off? And I had the courage to finally say, yeah, let's do that. Let's do that so we can build some bridges to people that aren't used to hearing things from a pulpit and feel like that's being lectured. Now, these may seem like really small changes to you, but all of these have been done with something in mind, with a purpose in mind. And that purpose is to appeal to men to help them to love Jesus. Here's a story. This is not in my sermon, but here's a story. That humankind is in a sinful place. That all of us have done bad things. Every one of us have done bad things. Some of us have done more than the rest of you. And because of that, God is angry. And the Bible says that His wrath is standing before us, waiting to consume us in our unholiness. But Jesus came from heaven as the Son of God and voluntarily put Himself on a cross to take on the wrath of God in His entire being. He took the wrath of God so that you and I don't have to. That's the story. And when we turn to Him and say, wow, I cannot believe you did that. Thank you. My sin is an awful thing. I want to turn away from it. I trust that your death paid for my sin. I will follow you. That is the culmination of all of God's purpose for humankind. Because in that, you're changed. You're forgiven. And you're made into a new person. Now, on Veterans Day or on other holidays, Memorial Day, we take moments to pay homage to those who have given their lives for us in the service of our country, and that is right to do. When I was at the Penguins game with my wife, they played O Canada, because there's a Canadian team there, and I stood for O Canada. And then they played the Star-Spangled Banner. And my hat, which I'd already taken off, I laid over my heart. Because I respect and I love the men and women who have given their lives so I have the freedom to talk to you like this today. How much more do I respect, admire, and love the one who gave His life on a cross for my sin? That's the story. And that underlies everything I'm going to say to you today about men and how they need to behave and even how we need to work to touch them. the value the Kermansville Alliance adopted at a meeting we had almost a year ago. That value goes like this. We build men who love God. Men who love God take responsibility. They grow healthy families. They create effective ministry. And they build stronger communities. Now, as soon as I say this, any thinking person would say, why men? I mean, don't women build healthy families? Don't women make effective ministry happen? Don't women help communities be stronger? Absolutely. Well, then why men? And there's a number of reasons. The first one is because of their absence. Because of the absence of men is one of the reasons we want to build men and we target them. I'm going to give you a lot of statistics today, and I'm going to give them to you as quickly as I can. And I will have some scripture to share with you. I'll place most of it on the screen to save you having to look it up, but I will give you the references if you want to look that up. But let me talk to you about the absence of men in churches today. A typical U.S. congregation draws an adult crowd that is 61% female. That means the remainder of that crowd, the remainder of that crowd, the 39%, is male. In fact, on any given Sunday in the United States of America, there are 13 million more adult women than men in America's churches. This Sunday, almost 25% of the married church-going women will worship alone without their husbands at their side. Almost 25%. Midweek activities at church draw 70 to 80% female attendance. 20 to 30% are men in midweek activities. More than 90% of American men believe in God, and 5 out of 6 call themselves Christians, but only 1 out of 6 can be found in church on any given Sunday. The average man accepts the reality of Jesus, but fails to see any value in going to church. And overseas, the gender gap is even greater. For every 9 women in church in Europe, there's 1 man in church in Europe. And Christian universities, Christian colleges, Christian universities, they're starting to look like convents. Because, well, my daughter went to a Christian school. She graduated a couple of years ago. When she went there, there was 2 girls for every boy. Sounds like a Beach Boys song, doesn't it? And I'm thinking to myself, where was that school when I was going to college? I think I did well. Fewer than 10%. This is startling. Think about the men's group we have at Kermansville Alliance, the men's groups we have at Kermansville Alliance, and hear this statistic. Fewer than 10% of U.S. churches are able to establish or maintain a vibrant men's ministry. Less than 1 in 10 can do that. Now, it would appear that churches haven't done a very good job attracting men. We've done well attracting women, but who is attracting men? One reason we have this value is because of the absence of men. A second reason is because of the influence of men. If you were here when Matt and I kind of co-preached the sermon when we did the resolution for men, if you were here at that time, some of this is redundant to you, but let me just share it with you very quickly, if I can. And I want to talk first about, well, before I say this, I do want to say this is going to talk about what happens when there's no man active in a person's life. And let me just say, these are generalizations. All of this is generalizations. So you and I all know families in which there was no man and the kids turned out great. And we know families in which there was a godly Christian dad and the kids turned out terrible. So these are generalities. These are not laws. But let me just read to you from Kendrick and Alcorn's book about what happens when fathers are absent. And the first thing they say is the research is staggering. They say prisoners, drug users, dropouts, runaway, and rapists all share something in common. The overwhelming majority of them come from homes without a father. Kids are 20 more times likely to end up in prison if their dad is not involved in their lives. Wow. And generally, that's sons that we're thinking of. What about daughters? Young women entering life without a deep sense of value and worth rather than displaying feminine charm, modesty, grace, have become nearly, if not equally, as rude and unrestrained as a stereotypical guy. They are told to act like and outdo men as much as possible. Flirty, immodest, and aggressive, they stay in a constant search for acceptance and attention. Things they haven't been freely given by the one man in their life whose love and approval they really want. And millions of teenage girls auction away their priceless virginity over every year for a piece of pizza, a movie, and some on-the-spot flattery, each of them hoping that being held for a few minutes by a porn-addicted teenage boy with raging hormones will somehow fill the dark canyon of love that the disengaged father has left aching inside of her, and it never does. Strong words. Strong words. But those are the facts. The consistently missing piece of the puzzle? Fathers. So the absence of a father can be a real problem. On the other hand, think about it when men stand up and be men and engage. Think of how great that is. I mean, you have the concept of provision. Not that the man has to be the breadwinner. I'm not saying that at all. But basically, you do think of the dad as being able to provide some of the life essentials. Think of the concept of protection. There's just something that I remember being a kid and knowing my dad was just in the door across the steps from me. And I was safe because he was there. And even leadership, providing spiritual direction for the family. I'm not saying that families without a dad or a husband don't have those things. I'm just saying the hill is steeper for them when they don't have those things. We build men because of their influence. And we build men who love God because of their call. In my adult life, I've heard many, many, many times that the father is kind of the priest for his family. I'm not sure I always understood what that meant. But I would just say it this way to you first. We have a call to pray for our families as men. And I think of that in the life of Job. If you're the kind of person who wants to follow along, you can. I'll have some of these verses on the screen. We'll only be in Job for a moment. But in Job chapter 1, listen to these words. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. He was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And then in verse 4 it says, Job's sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their 3 sisters to come and eat and drink with them. When the period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And this was Job's regular custom. Here's all he's doing in modern day terms. He's saying, I know my kids are at college and I know there's a lot of sin at college, God. Please help them steer clear of that. Jesus, please help my son and my daughter to be holy and forgive them for times that they mess up. Keep them from trouble. I'm praying this in Jesus' name, amen. He's just interceding for his kids. That's what men are called to do, to intercede. More directly, the Bible says we're even supposed to be teaching our kids. Psalm 78, I'd never really paid a lot of attention to that psalm until I was preparing this message. Let me read a few verses, a half a dozen verses from it to you. It says, O my people, hear my teaching, listen to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth with parables. I will utter hidden things, things of old, what we have heard and known, what our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, His power, and the wonders He has done. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established a law for Israel, which He commanded our forefathers to teach their children so the next generation would know them, and even the children yet to be born, so that they in turn would tell their children. There it is. Men, you and I have a responsibility to tell our kids of the faith of our parents. And if our parents didn't have any faith, we need to tell them of our own. Either way, to express the faith of our parents. Don't hide behind this excuse, guys. Well, you know, I don't do that very well. My wife is a lot more verbal. She has verbal skills that put me to shame. In fact, I've never won an argument with my wife. I think I'll leave that up to my wife. You tell them about Jesus. I'm going to go rake the leaves or something. I'll shovel the walk. Don't do that. Don't hide that way, guys. You have a call to teach your family about God. And that is why we build men who love God. We build men who love God because God seems to hold men responsible for their families. Think of Adam and Eve in the garden. Which one of them sinned? Well, Eve, right? She took the apple. It was all Eve's fault. I've heard that, you know. It was all Eve's fault. Well, wait a minute. Adam's standing right there with her because she gave some to the man who was with her. Why is he being silent? That's sin in my mind. Just let Satan take advantage of your wife. How's that being godly? Not at all. And then he eats it as well. They're both guilty. That's the conclusion you're forced to reach, that they're both guilty. And so I would think that when God came into the garden to address this, he would say, hey, you two, come here right now. Just like I did when I had kids at home. Timothy, Esther Lynn, get in here right now. You're both in trouble, right? But God doesn't do that. In fact, if you look at the text in Genesis 3:9, it says, the Lord God called to the man, where are you? And he addressed the problem with Adam first, because it seems that God holds the man responsible for his family. The very same thing happens with Abraham and Sarah. Sarah laughs. God doesn't say, why did you laugh? He says, why did your wife laugh? You're responsible to be a spiritual leader in this family, man. We build men who love God because God holds men responsible for their families. Those are just some of the reasons we build men who love God, but maybe we should talk about what does it mean to love? Because words get messy sometimes. I know adult men with adult children who've said to me, I can't tell my son or daughter I love them. That just sounds weird to me to say that. I tell my kids I love them every time I get off the phone with them. But I think the reason that we feel a little weird about doing that sort of thing is because we kind of feel like that would be for sissies. Like, oh, isn't love kind of a sissy thing, you know? Not at all. Because loving God both requires and demands great strength. Can I give you some examples of the incredible un-sissy-like behavior that has come from men who love God? How about a guy who said, I love Jesus, and his community centuries ago said, stop saying that, or we are going to have you torn apart by horses. Let me explain to you what that means. That means I'm going to tie your right leg to that horse and his harness. I'm going to tie your left leg to that horse and this harness. I'm going to tie your arm to that horse and his harness, and your other arm to that one, and I'm going to say, mush. Well, that would be dogs, right? But I'm gonna whip those horses and you'll be pulled apart. No, 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 that's okay. Because I love God too much to back down. And that is how the man died. You know, there are infinite stories concerning this. People being eaten by lions in the Colosseum. All they would have had to do is say, I recant my faith, and they wouldn't recant their faith. Or what about, there's a guy who was slowly roasted over fire. Man, as soon as it got warm, a sissy would say, I recant, I recant. He didn't. In fact, kind of some urban legends grow up around these things. And the urban legend with that one is, and I'm not sure, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but the story is true. The details get a little bit exaggerated, I think. And it says this, it said, after he was burned on one side, he said to his tormentors, I think I'm done on that side. Turn me over and do the other side. Don't know if he really said that, but here's what I know. He didn't recant because he knew what love was. And he loved the one who had come and died for him. I could give you more stories of people being skinned alive, tied to an anchor and thrown into the sea. One guy was shot by archers, you know, like an archer firing squad. That seems kind of primitive. Well, it was. It was olden days. An archer firing squad, they thought he's dead. They left him. He woke up, pulled the arrows out, went back into the city and started preaching again, and they bludgeoned him to death. What would make you do that? Love for the one who gave it all. I'll stand I'll stand for the one who gave it all because I love him. See, loving God requires great strength. And the love of real men is really a chosen life commitment. It's a chosen commitment. I told you I had a couple sports illustrations. A couple of these come from the Steelers. If you're not a fan, you have my sympathy. But let me just share these with you, okay? When Jerome Bettis retired from the Pittsburgh Steelers, there was another man on the field whose name was Alan Faneca. Alan Faneca was an offensive lineman, one of the best in the business at that time. He was later taken by the Jets because the Steelers couldn't afford to retain him with a salary cap. Alan Faneca, when Jerome Bettis retired, said these words, "I love Jerome Bettis. He means the world to me." Real men love. Real men love. Or how about this, Joey Porter. It's real hard to find a tougher linebacker than Joey Porter. Joey Porter was talking about Coach Cower in 2006, and he said these words about his coach, "I love that man. I would go to war with Coach Cower anytime." Real men love. Real men love. Or how about the Clemson football coach, Dado Swinney? I think that's how you say his name. How do you say D-A-D-O if it's a name? Dado? I don't know. Anyway, I read this quote from him. He just said this past fall. He was speaking about his team. He said, "They're mature, they're growing, they're getting older. They understand the moments. These guys love each other. They really care about each other. These coaches do a good job with these guys. They show a lot of care. I love coaching this football team." And I thought to myself when I read that, that is how I feel about Kerwinsville Alliance. The men in this church love each other. They like being together with one another. They encourage one another. They build one another up. I love pastoring this church. You understand that? Real men love. And real men love God. I don't know if you ever go to the IamSecond.com website, but if you don't, you should. It's a great website. All it is they have this black background. They have a guy sitting in a chair with light on him. This particular week, it happens to be Mike Fisher, who plays hockey. He plays for the Nashville Predators. Mike Fisher is there, and all he does for about 8 minutes is talk about his life journey with God. He tells his story, his testimony. He tells about his faith. He tells about his struggles. He tells about his love for God. And then I listened to it like 3 or 4 times this week, and I pulled this sentence out of it. Listen to this sentence. "I love him, the Father. His love is unconditional." Real men love God. We hold this value because of what happens when we build men who love God. And the first thing that happens is families are healthier. You know, a couple decades ago, there was a movement sweeping the nation called Promise Keepers. A number of us went. Remember going to Promise Keepers, Jim? We almost lost Brennan there. Brennan, I'm glad you're here, buddy. Whew. Jim said, "If I'd have lost him, I couldn't have gone home." True, huh, Sid? None of us could if we lost our kid on the way. Promise Keepers was an enigma. That is, it was a mystery to much of the more liberal media. I can remember sitting in front of my computer. For those of you that are geeks, it was a 486 running on dial-up, okay? So that's kind of like black and white TV back in the day. And I can remember sitting there and I'm listening to NPR, and it's, you know, I'm listening, "This is NPR with a report from our," it was a female correspondent, "who is interviewing the Promise Keepers' wives. And now to her," and so here she is. And she's interviewing these wives, and she's anticipating. Her question is loaded. Isn't that odd that the media would ever have a loaded question? And her question is, "How do you handle the idea that Promise Keepers promote that the man needs to be the leader in his family? I think we're in a day of equality, and women have equal rights. What is this business of the man being the leader? I think that's wrong. What do you think?" And each one she interviewed, it was just so puzzling to her. She couldn't understand it. Each woman she interviewed, without exception, said, "I love having a husband who has a commitment to God because it makes our family healthier and richer." Yeah. Yeah. We build men who love God so their families will be healthier. And we do this as well so that ministry will be more effective. I've heard different numbers from different studies. I've shared some of those with you. Listen to the outcome of this study. I think it might have been conducted by Touchstone Magazine. They reported anyway. Number one, if both father and mother attend church regularly, 33% of the children will end up as regular churchgoers, and 41% of them will end up attending irregularly. Okay? So just think of those numbers across the board. If the dad and the mom are both there, a third of the families, a third of the children in the families will become regulars in church as well. Second, if a father attends irregularly and a mother regularly, only 3% of the children subsequently become regular attenders themselves, with a further 59% attending irregularly. Wow, that's dramatic, isn't it? And you know what? I know what you can do. I do it myself. I can think of illustrations in the past several years of ministry, decades of ministry, where the mom came and the dad, he just didn't come with any regularity. And now I look at the adult kids and I see the sins of the fathers visited upon the children. If a father is non-practicing and a mother regularly, the number drops to 2% that become regular worshipers. There's something about a man's influence. There just is. And I'm guessing that many extreme feminists don't like hearing that. But it's something we need to know, that men have influence. Now, you may not want that burden, men. You may be sitting here thinking, I don't want that burden. And you may be kind of like a whiny sports athlete guy standing behind a podium who kind of got caught doing something bad, saying, well, I never signed up to be a role model, you know. And when you hear them say that, don't you just want to throttle that athlete, you know? Grow up. You live in a real world that has real obligations. You've been given an incredible gift. Be a man. Be a man. I think that's the same thing that God would say to you and me. Grow up. You might not like it that you have this influence, but be a man. You have a chance to make a huge difference in the lives of people. You have a church that wants to facilitate that in every way they can. Think about the ministry in Kerbinsville Alliance Church, the men's group. You know, how many guys were there yesterday, Matt? Probably 8 or 9. And it felt empty, didn't it? Yeah. We actually have enough guys that we could start another small men's group. Tim has a men's group on Tuesday night. Doesn't have a strong attendance. It's kind of a different time. I think 7:30 in the morning is a little easier for guys. But he has up to, how many have you had? If everyone came, you'd have about 5 or 6 guys. 7 guys if everyone came. And that's at your home. And Tim, just wave, Tim, so everyone knows who you are. And Tim would welcome guys to come and join him there. And real men have women who bake. This is truth. This is truth. And so there's always good food there, right? So guys, we want to build men who love God because how it changes the ministry. I read the Alliance Men's Report this past week. I typed it actually for Lloyd. And the numbers had increased from like 10 to 15. Instead, it's like 20 or 25 people, men, who come to breakfast on a monthly basis. That's just, don't ever lose the preciousness of that, Kerwinsville Alliance. Such a blessing. Every man has influence in this world. We exert it for the sake of the kingdom. And if we men exert our godly influence, families are stronger, ministries more effective, and even communities tend to be stronger. And it's easy to understand how, because men who love God are men whose life is marked by integrity. Men who love God are men whose lives are marked by honesty and by compassion and caring. And even industry, you know, doing the right thing. And when your town is marked by that, your town is simply a better place to live. Now, I know that this core value is really, really politically incorrect. But we believe it with all our hearts. I mean, when we're talking about the core values, sometimes someone will say, I don't know if that's as important. And we're just talking as a group about that. But no one denied this one. It is not just who we want to be, it is who we are. And I was talking to someone recently. Perhaps my wife told me this. I'm not certain who, but I did get permission to share it. There's a family that comes to our church, and the dad is absent. He's not just absent from church, he's absent from the family. There is not a lot of male role model in that family. And that mom brings her boys to Kermansville Alliance because of this value. Because she sees godly men here at Kermansville Alliance. And she wants her boys to see that. She wants her boys to see that men will play instruments and honor God with their voices and with their talents. She wants her boys to see that men will come out every Sunday night and work with 20 kids to help them know Jesus better. Men come out and do that along with women at Kermansville Alliance. And she wants her boys to see that. She wants her boys to see that it's not just Pastor Steve who gets paid to do the prayer on Sunday morning, but it was Josh Stachick this morning, and it'll be another man next week. It is not that we do not value women. It is not that we do not think women can do those things. We really target men because we want to grow them into godly men who love God. She sees that, and she thinks, this is a place I want my kids. It's not politically correct, but it is biblically correct. It's appropriate. It's healthy. It's one of our values.